Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Enterprise Business 100 for Spring Semester 2014. Special Lecture 1, delivered on March 4, 2014. The title of this lecture is Business Law.
Today, law. This is the first of two lectures that will cover ground in topics in law that have to do with business. There will be a lot of general information behind this, and this is by no means enough so that you can go and do law work, I guarantee. Don't try to be a lawyer after this, but it will show you things that you don't know, I guarantee you. Later in your, if you're not in there already, you will take a course called Legal Environment of Business, and that one will do a larger survey than I can possibly do in one day. However, you will find that the material is pretty much what I'm saying here will be what you hear in the legal environment of business class. Let me take you on a couple of quick passes at some basic definitions. First of all, what is law?
Rules you have to abide by.
Rules to abide by. Most people, when they say when I ask that, they do use that word rules. We'll find that that's actually probably okay to use that term, but there's a lot more to it than that, and I'm sure you probably appreciate that there's a lot more to law than just rules. But that's a place to start. Now, when I talk about law, you're going to find out that in this lecture and in the next lecture, that's more on contract law, there's going to be quite a bit where I break law down into two dimensions. Well, there's this and there's this, and they are not the same. So let me start that out right now as I fool around here. The first way I will break law into two parts, into two distinct types, is statutory and common law. And I will start with the one that is somewhat younger, more recent in human history. By definition, it would be more recent. Statutory law, and I know there are those who would shoot me for how simplistically I'm doing this, but they can bite me. I'm trying to get some basic ideas down here. Statutory law is written law, law that's written down. That's not the only kind of law there is. And as a matter of fact, that's not the way law was originally. And it's not the way law is in many countries still to this day. But statutory law is written law. Many countries around the world, especially in certain parts of the world, have all of their laws written down so that if there is ever a question, a case, a question of law, a case in law, then the judge or the adjudicator looks to the written law. And that letter is the answer. The greatest example, perhaps, in all of human history, or one of the greatest examples, was Lex Romana, the law of the Romans. Lex Romana was written law. Wherever the Romans were, wherever they occupied nations, they imposed Lex Romana. It was written. So in France, to this day, there will be written, France is a written law country, specifically an evolution of the Napoleonic Code. Well, obviously, it has to be this way. Latin is the only important language on earth. It's God's language. And the Romans spoke Latin. The Romans created law and all of that kind of stuff. So obviously, everything has to be written law. A judge will look at a case and then will apply the written law to the facts of the case. No questions asked. Very simple in that way. But it's not so simple. Because Lex Romana, as time went on, Lex Romana became larger and larger. Well, there ought to be a law. Well, law was passed by the Roman Senate with the advice and consent or the imposition of the rule of the emperor or the Caesar. Well, I want a law for my specific needs. Okay, if you got money, we'll put a law on the books. Well, I think this is wrong. Okay, we'll put a law on the books if you've got enough muscle to get it to our attention. Over and over again, this happened. Law that had been accessible to every citizen of the Roman Empire over the centuries became less and less meaningful to anyone. The joke went around eventually, well, you need a lawyer. Well, I was going to get this lawyer. Oh, no, he specializes in page 8,226. You need page 8,227. So he's not the lawyer you need. Okay? So you understand that that created a clientele that could afford the law, and then everyone else was simply a victim of the law or was outside of the rules of the law. The Roman law was harsh, but it was also had many, many fairnesses to it and many things that you would say, well, that's cool. Okay, I understand that. But it was written law. And as time went on, fewer and fewer people could afford that law. In the late summer, in September of AD 476, the Visigoths came to Rome to sack it for the last time. By then, who was there to protect that shattered dream that was the shining light of civilization from one end of the earth to the other? The generals had already made their alliances. Rome itself was so pathetic that the warlord Audica of the German tribes, the Arian Christians, he didn't even execute the emperor. The emperor was such a pathetic piece of little trash. It was that bad. The people, the commoners, here comes another foot on us. Who cares? We don't. Merchants, we've been screwed for so long. Why would we take up arms? Why would we fight for what has lost its meaning to us? Lex Romana had become so large that it could not be seen by anyone, and therefore it became meaningless. It's like these scientists now, look at the incredible universe we're taking pictures of. Who the hell cares? How does that feed me today? How does that give me a job? How does that give meaning to my life when you're telling me I'm nothing compared to this ginormous cloud of galaxies? That's what happens when you get things too large. No one cares anymore. And Rome didn't fall. It just quietly faded away. It was such an incredible book of law, though, that when the Visigoths had consolidated their power, they didn't throw out Lex Romana. They just simply turned it into their version, Lex Romana Visigoth, the Visigoths' law of the Romans. But what was funny about it was that the Visigoths had kings and scholars and monks and intellectuals and historians try to figure out what in the hell Lex Romana was so that they could say, all right, Roman citizens of the world will be under this Lex Romana. They couldn't figure out where are all of the books. I mean, we don't even know where all the law is. So what ended up was for about a century, there was this kind of hodgepodge mishmash that was called Lex Romana Visigoth that applied to Romans, but it was like they'd take a few laws from books they found, some information, some rules from constitutions, some ideas from writers who had been knowledgeable about parts of Lex Romana. It was just like a hodgepodge because no one really grasped, knew what it was in its entirety. It was that obtuse. But interestingly enough, though, like I said, everywhere that the Roman Empire had occupied was under and put under statutory law is pretty much to this day a statutory law country. They have all their laws in writing. Romans had some problems. Sometimes they ran in. You think about the Romans just rolled over everybody. To a certain extent, they did. They would not quit until they had won a fight. If they had to bring in more troops, they would do it, and they would knock them down. But as the Roman Empire extended and expanded farther and farther, they began to run into places where they did not have absolute control. And in fact, sometimes where they had control became a problem because people from other places began to migrate into their territories. And then they'd have to provide them with services, and that meant higher taxes for Roman citizens. That got to be a little bit of a problem over time. But one place that never fell actually completely to the Romans was Germania. Places in Germania. The Germanic tribes, they were Arian Christian, and they had helped the Roman Empire in some battles. That was why a Roman emperor finally embraced Christianity, because the Christian warlords were so powerful. They were hellaciously good fighters. Hell, they'd been fighting the Roman Empire since Nero. But so there was kind of this odd relationship going on there. But the Arians, the Germanic tribes, they were not Roman. They were German. Just like the people north of them, the Northmen, which you might call Vikings, which is a ridiculously stupid-ass term. The Northmen, the peoples to the east, not well conquered. And so you saw in these lands a different kind of law. A law that is not written down because these people didn't write. Well, they kind of did. Some of the Christian monks had taught them how to write, or they had rudimentary writing of their own. But they weren't writers. Everything was oral, or important things were oral. So when they talk about law, they talk about law that is passed down orally from elders to the sons who become the elders to the sons. It is common law. The law of the tribe. The Romans even have, there's even a Latin term, stare decisis. Stare decisis. You could think almost literally, stare at the decision. Respect the decision. Look to the decision. In other words, we respect the past. We see how this kind of a case has been decided before. And we use that as our guiding light for a decision now. That decision might have been 2,000 years ago, but it has passed down. Now, times change, and there's a fluidity. Well, this isn't quite the same. We have new circumstances that really didn't. So we have, the elders would have the ability, but they would use it extraordinarily sparingly to alter an old decision. But for the most part, they were tethered to their history. That's very different from what we are now. Most of you couldn't tell me the generals of World War II. You wouldn't know shit about World War I. You don't care. I've got my Google Glass. I could go to Wikipedia whenever I need some of that stupid, boring stuff. This is not how tribal law is. This is not how tribal life is. It is tied to the past because that's your tether. Because otherwise, you're just like, did any of you see that movie Gravity? That is a metaphor. You are going into a void called the future. Common law keeps that void from coming, because you are always tethered to the decisions of the past. That does not mean the past is right. And there are certainly times when the past has been wrong and the decisions have been vicious, sexist, misogynistic, racist. But we have the ability to change that. In our Constitution, you don't have the right to vote in the original Constitution because you're a woman. It's written down in the Constitution. You're 3/5 of a human being in our Constitution as it was originally formed. Written down ain't so good, is it? But fortunately, we are not all written down. I want to explain something to you here. As I said, Germanic tribes were not statutory law. They actually didn't even... Pretty much, they didn't even understand what Lex Romana was about. Well, it kind of works, and the Romans do it, so we'll let the Romans keep doing that. What the hell, whatever it is. But think about this. Think about how cool this is. That the Germans, we don't know, we have some ideas, but there have been movies that have kind of misrepresented it. But in the 4th and 5th centuries of the Christian era, the German tribes in the lowlands of Germany, that would be up in the place towards the English Channel, they started migrating across the channel. It could have been population pressure. There's also some evidence of some environmental things that were going on, but they started coming. Three specific tribal groups, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. And they were interesting because they were common law. They came into England, and there was pretty much shards of the Roman Empire there. Some of the old ancient peoples who had been there, the Picts and groups like that had been there. But the German tribes just rolled over them pretty much quickly. You might have seen these movies about Saxons, these helmet-wearing, violent drinking nutcases and all that in movies. They weren't quite that, although, well, yeah, they were. But they came in, and they rolled over, and they became the inhabitants, the dominant inhabitants of England, what you call England. Now, there was not an England per se. There were tribal warlord areas of control, some of them small, some of them big, in the early centuries after the tribes, after the Germanic tribes had come in. But when they came in, they brought their common law with them. That Roman law that had been there during the Roman occupation, gone very quickly. Any other kind of law that had been around, gone. So what we consider to be England, this amalgamation of tribal warlord lands, Germanic tribal warlord lands, was common to them, was this common law. Oral law, law of the ancients, law of the elders. Stare decisis, look to the past. Always respect your ancestors. Well, anyway, and interestingly, well, they had their own version of the inhabitants were just, they were used to Roman law or some their own ways, and they just could not figure out these Anglo-Saxons at all. They say, well, you worship the white Christ. You don't write. You just say. All of your stories are in poetry. Even your prayers are actually kind of like, you don't even understand your own religion, this thing called Christianity, because you keep referring back to Viking kinds of ideas. From heaven to the roof of the longhouse is how they described the afterlife. They were still talking about like Odin and all that. You guys are weird. But as time went on, several of the kings consolidated area and common law spread, and a common law spread. And it was powerful. It was heavy. It was good. It was ancient. They had brought it from their homelands. And so the English, as Which they were. These Germanic tribes were, by this time, maybe the 9th century, 10th century, they were English. This was a common law country, England was. Well, unfortunately, they kept getting into fights with the French. And one group of French tribes, interestingly enough, Germanic French, called the Normans, finally laid siege in a confrontation that culminated in a battle in AD 1066. It was called the Battle of Hastings. And it was won by the French. The poem that is written about this from a person of the time who was there is just the grimmest, darkest piece of poetry you will ever want to read. It has horror, it has gore, it is just incredible in its depth of description of how bad it was, when, especially the part where it describes Harold, the king of the English, staggering up to a tree and just falling down and bleeding to death. But it was now the French in control, and the French were statutory law. The French imagined themselves as the inheritors of civilization from the great ancient Roman Empire. Everything had to turn back to Rome. You even wrote your laws. You wrote your laws like the Romans did, and you wrote them in Latin. Everything was lex Romana, high civilization, and all that. Well, you can imagine how that set with the English, who were not exactly the most civilized people on earth. But they lived under it. They had to, because the French were putting their kings in there, and the French were running the show. And so what came about, the French even tried to impose their language. They tried to force French down our throats in England, and it didn't exactly work. What we did instead was two things. One was, English is such an incredible language because if it gets a word that looks cool, we'll just take it and use it. And if we decide we like the word again a few decades or a century later, we'll take it and we'll use it again in a different way. Chef, chief, skipper, they're all from the same French word. We just kept taking it and trying something new with it. The French did do a few things to us. Like, one thing was, an Anglo-Saxon, you're an Anglo-Saxon woman, you're hungry. I want to eat cow. Well, of course you do. The French were horrified. You don't call what you eat the animal. We call it buff. Buff? Buff. Well, isn't it a cow? Well, yes, but you don't call it that. Well, can I have some pig? No, you can have pork. Well, isn't pork pig? Yes, but you don't call. The French were just so upset by those kinds of things. One other thing was that whenever you have an occupation language impose itself on a native language, the native language will go from a very complex thing to a much simpler thing. English, Old English, is inordinately complex. It took me years to be able to speak it fluently. Years. It's worse than Latin. But after a few decades under the Roman inheritors, the French, English began to simplify. It stopped using the back ends, what we call inflections. It stopped using weird different conjugations for nouns. It got simple. In a period of one 50-year period, the monks in a temple, they would write in a book every year what was going on. At the beginning of the French occupation, in Old English, the monk wrote for the year, on the somiera. That was how we would say it in Old English. But 50 years later, the monks, still speaking English, wrote in their book of chronicles, on this year. The French were actually making us stronger. But what happened was they imposed the statutory law system on England. Written law. We will have courts and judges. They will speak Latin. They will adjudicate according to the written laws that God passed down to the Christian kings. And that's how it'll be. Well, as time went on, eventually the French just kind of fizzled away. They were, after all, German-French to begin with. And over a period of just a few centuries, by the time you get into the 1400s, you start to see legal documents coming back up in English. You start to see writing. Like, for example, by the time of Shakespeare, Shakespeare actually wrote in his plays what wasn't true. He wrote several plays where the kings could not speak French in the Middle Ages. Well, that's complete bullshit. They were consummate in French. They were French kings. But by the time you get even to Shakespeare, Shakespeare could tell a noble lie. We were never even close to being French. So what happened, though, was we got this weird mishmash system come out. It is common law with written law put into it. And that's how England came out of the Middle Ages. A common law country with an overlay of statutory law. There were written laws, but there were judges who would still look to the past for decision making. Then when English started coming to the New World, of course, the first settlers were actually English that were so unpopular in England that they were pretty much driven out. It was all about religious freedom. No, it was about a bunch of assholes that everyone got sick of. They were so uptight, so mean, that they were just chased out. So they came to the United States. And by the time we get to the founding of our country, in 1776, we had our Declaration of Independence. A few, not too many years later, we had our Constitution written. The Constitution is written law. It is a constitution. It is a written document. So the presidents were pretty much in this idea, we rejected kings and all that, but we still are sort of like kings. George Washington wasn't like the way we pretend he was now. There are still parts of the country generations later that spit on the ground if you mention Washington's name, considering what he and his booze merchant buddies did to kill off all the small-time whiskey makers in the Tennessee and Ohio valleys. But, you know, they were kind of running it like, we're going to write laws, and that's the law. But the Constitution had a Supreme Court specified in it. There was a Supreme Court listed in the Constitution. And so, before too long, still in the 1700s, a case went to the Supreme Court. It was Marbury v. Madison. And the Supreme Court took this case and made it so that the United States law would always be subject to judicial review. Congress, you can write law, and it's the highest law there is, no question about that, until or unless we decide that it's not constitutional. We have the right to do that. We can strip your law of its validity if it does not pass constitutional muster. What that meant was that we were no longer under the rule of written laws and a constitution that was just a document. We were now ruled by constitutional law. Constitution doesn't mean anything. It's how it has been interpreted. In other words, there are legislatures that are trying nonsense all the time. They'll pass a law, but if it gets to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court says, no, that's unconstitutional, law is over. That law is gone. Done. That is how con law works, you see. This talk about, well, that's not in the Constitution, doesn't matter. Constitutional law is what governs us. And the judges in this country respect stare decisis. They look to the past. Sometimes they look too hard to the past, but they look to the past. So when you see this thing, these types of, it's especially conservatives, who say, we need to go back to literal interpretation of the Constitution. Look at the Constitution. No, you don't. That's not how it works. You look to the decisions made by the Supreme Court. Well, the judges are activists. Well, yeah. You don't want the judges to be activists? Go to France. Go to Rome. Because our judges have the right, via Marbury v. Madison, of judicial review. Judicial review. Now, you need to keep that in mind. Because even in dark, dark times, and you are laboring in a dark time, where corporations tell you what to do and play the games they do with you, you struggle to find a job, where the government is looking at everything you're doing and it just laughs its ass off at any complaint because you can't stop it from doing what it's doing. We are still under the rule of law. And someday, as has happened in the past, the judges reach back out and they say, no more. You can write all the laws you want saying it's okay for this to happen and that to happen, but the judges will say, no, go away. You've got all these laws. They're all invalid now. They're unconstitutional. Go. And that is important because that is the saving grace of a free society. Not the statutory laws, not the Constitution, but the right of the elders to look back to the past and say, what were we when we were great? There are other ways to divide law. Let me give you a few of those ways right now. And there are so many different ways. I'm just going to give you a little smattering of them here. One way that I could divide law is into criminal law versus civil law. This one is important to us in business. You see, civil law covers interpersonal actions. Now remember when I say that a person, I've said this before a number of times, a person doesn't have to be an actual human being. So civil law would cover a dispute between two corporations, or between a human and a corporation. Civil law would cover a dispute between the government and a corporation in some cases. Civil law deals with interpersonal. Civil law goes back to ancient times. It is very much a part of common law. So, for example, just pulling one out of my head, in Anglo-Saxon, there is a word called a word that is pronounced hamsokken. Hamsokken. Okay, hamsokken means that you punch someone on his own property. It just says, what? Yeah, it happened. And hamsokken would fall under a civil law, at least at first. Well, you punched me. You did a wrong against me. You did a civil wrong. That's called a tort. A civil wrong against another is a tort. You committed a tort. Well, you see, civil law seeks something very important. It takes the blood out of disputes. Way too often, even to this day, and in many parts of the world, just a minor wrong of one person against another, or even a large wrong, turns into an intergenerational blood feud. Civil law seeks to stop that. No, you may not kill him for what he did to you. You may take him and show your grievance to a court. And from that grievance, the court may, if the evidence supports it, impose upon him a monetary fine. But you can't kill him. You can't hit him back. Well, I want to beat him up. Well, if you do that, then he can sue you. Well, he came into my property, so I shot him. By God, it's my property. I got a gun and I got the Second Amendment. Bullshit. In our system, you don't do that because that's not how it works. Because his family will come back and kill you. And then your family will go back and shoot their dog. And then that family will come back and shoot your cat. And before you know it, you won't have any pets, and she'll be dead, and I'll be dead. Civil law seeks to stop that before it ever starts because we don't want to be like Scotsmen. See, do you understand the idea of why civil law exists? It keeps us from falling apart as a society down to blood feud. It's great to talk about it in movies. I am going to avenge my daughter's deflowering. No. You see, laugh now, but watch me. I'm a dad. I've got a shotgun, 5 acres, a shovel, and I got alibis, bitch. But you understand what we're talking about here is civil law keeps us civil. Us a civil society. And you might think, well, that takes all the fun out of it. Yeah. It also keeps the civilization in our society. That's why for so long we circumscribed. The Second Amendment wasn't about idiots strutting around with their damn guns. It was about people being able to defend their property and themselves, but not hurting each other. Not just, I'm going to settle this a man's way. Blam, see? Let me take you to criminal law. Criminal law is sometimes misunderstood because criminal law is essentially the sovereign taking issue with you. I punch you. Well, you can sue me person to person. But the sovereign may also choose to prosecute me in another way. But know this. If the sovereign chooses to prosecute me because I punched you, the sovereign doesn't give a rat's ass about you. The sovereign represents the people. Not you. You are an asset to the sovereign in testimony, in evidence, and other evidence. But you in and of yourself, the sovereign isn't doing you anything. The sovereign will pander to you. We're going to do this for you, ma'am. I'm a prosecutor, and I know that was an awful thing, so we're prosecuting that son of a bitch to the highest extent of the law. Bullshit. They're not doing that for you. They're doing that for the sovereign. The counts, the people versus. Not the people on behalf of this person versus. It's the people. When criminal law is applied, criminal law is applied to the effect and purpose of defending the society, not the victim. Understand that. You have civil law for that. But if it's criminal law, it is the sovereign. Well, do you want to press criminal charges against him? Sounds like they're talking about doing this on your behalf. No, what they're doing is wanting to see if you have the commitment to provide sufficient asset at a trial. You'll find that there are some times where you want to press charges and the police don't want you to. I've had that happen on a number of occasions. It's just not worth it for them because there's not enough of a people's, in a large sense, interest to save it, to make it worth their while. Woman, what do you notice about my nose?
It's
Yeah, go ahead, say it. Say it.
It's kind of big, you know. It's a little pointy. But it fits your face.
Oh, well, that makes me feel good. Damn, it's ugly nose and it fits your face, you ugly bastard. What else do you notice about it? Look.
Tilted that way?
Yeah. Here's a rule. When you break your nose, don't try to fix it yourself. Now, second rule. If you break your nose again, don't think that you can fix the first thing you did wrong in the first break. See rule one. Fights I got into, there was almost never a time when the cops wanted anything to do with it. My nose is broken. I'm bleeding all over. You're walking away. Come back here, you idiot. Yeah, well, yeah. Go. Have a donut. I hope you choke on the jelly donut. But you see, you understand that the sovereign, at its discretion, prosecutes. rights. Now, remember, the sovereign can also press civil charges as well. So you can have the government can sue you and prosecute you criminally on the same charges. Sounds like double jeopardy? Well, it probably is, but the Supreme Court says it isn't, so there you are on that. But understand this, that criminal law, civil law has only money involved. Damages, fines, and all that. Okay, that's civil law. A wrong is rectified by money. Know this also, though, about what comes from our ancient past. In a civil claim, even until a couple of centuries, maybe more than a few centuries ago, if you had said, "I wronged you," and no one else saw it, you would have to prove that I had wronged you. This is where we get into the old meaning of the word prove. We think prove, in our modern language, we kind of changed the meaning of it. We think prove means established completely. This is proved. Actually, that's not what prove means. Prove means test. So if you are the only one that saw a wrong that I committed against you and you want to prosecute that wrong civilly, you have to be tested. That might mean something as serious as you have to walk across hot coals or something like that, or you have to suffer pain. You see, because since ancient times, we're not going to just say you claimed I did something to you. We have to have beyond a doubt that something happened. And the first thing we would want to do is to have you show that you did not doubt what had happened. If you are honest, the Lord will take care of you in your test. This comes to us today with the concept that you are not guilty until it is tested, proved beyond a certain threshold. Now, most juries just don't give a shit. Judges try their best to explain it to juries. Trust me, I've seen jury charges. Just because you don't like the guy, that's not enough. Well, the jury says, well, the hell with you, I don't like the guy, guilty. Here it is. First of all, first threshold, clear and compelling evidence. That's not enough to convict anyone, civilly or criminally. Clear and compelling, you think, well, that sounds pretty strong. Yeah, but that isn't enough even for a civil. The next one is preponderance of evidence. So in other words, not only is it clear and compelling, but there is most of the evidence points to the wrong having been done. That gets civil conviction. Doesn't have to be all of the jurors. It just has to be a majority of them. In criminal, it has to go even beyond that one. You have to have clear and compelling, clear up to preponderance of evidence, and then over preponderance of evidence comes beyond a reasonable doubt. So in other words, reasonable doubt could exist even though almost all the evidence is against someone. Reasonable doubt is a high, high threshold, which is not understood anymore. We have more people in our prison system than any other country on earth. Our rate, the per 100,000, is higher than any country on earth, including the despotic nations like communist China and nutcase Iran. We have more people in prison percentage-wise than those countries do, because we have forgotten that you don't just throw people in jail if you think, he's colored or she's bad or he's ugly. You have to show it to an insanely high level, but that's not how we do it. So there's another place where we have to try to start reaching back to the way it was. Might sound awful. Why are you making someone who was wrong say these, do these things? Because the alternative is for many, many people who don't deserve to be in prison to be there. Oh, so what? We'll just throw them in jail. And when they come out, what stake do they have in the society that wronged them? You see, you're not allowed to sue the government. Did you know that? It's called sovereign immunity. You are not allowed to sue the government unless the government passes a law giving you specific permission to do so. That applies to state government, to the federal government. You can't even sue the government if it has wronged you. The government might feel bad and pass a law saying, yeah, you can sue us because we really screwed you over. But it doesn't have to. Let me take you to some civil law that's important as we get to the business law. Moving towards business law. A couple of kinds of law that are important for us in business, but one that's not a business law, but it does have its implications, is tort law. Now, a tort, and I don't know if you were ever taught this or not, a tort is a civil wrong against another. A tort is a civil wrong against another. In other words, one person wrongs another person. Usually we think of it doesn't have to be this way, but usually you think of a tort to humans. So I could, for example, slap you. That's a tort. I wronged you, civilly wronged you. Let me give you an idea.
I am about to grab your buttock, and I will squeeze it slowly.
That's assault. Assault is only placing another at concern of imminent danger. It doesn't have to be fear, but it has to be imminent, and it has to be real. Assault is simply putting someone at concern for his or her safety. Now, if I grab your buttock, dude, you shave there. No, that's battery. That's battery. Battery is the unwanted touching of another. Touch. That's battery. Notice that there was no assault. You didn't know what was coming at you. No assault. It was battery, though. You think of battery, boom, 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 boom. No. Hey, all I have to do is just touch you, and you don't want me to. That can be rather dangerous, you can understand, but that's all battery has to be. Punching is battery, sure. But interestingly enough, there are many times when you have assault but no battery, and there are times when you have battery but no assault. And then there are times when there's both assault and battery, both. I've been sucker punched in my life. There was no assault. I didn't know it was coming, so there couldn't be an assault, but there was a battery that was involved. I had a gun put to my face. That is assault with a deadly weapon, but it is not battery. Now, understand that that's civil. I can sue. You could sue. You could sue for the different things. There's a criminal version of these as well, of course. Many torts have a criminal version. But in and of itself, a tort is just a civil wrong against another. And hamsakan, what I brought up before, that's a tort. There could be a criminal version of it, but just the punching, that was battery and nothing else. Now, torts can be of all kinds. You could even imagine, well, a worker was hurt in the workplace. That's sort of like a tort, a wrong against, it was a tort of negligence. The workplace was not safe. The guy hurt himself. I don't know that you would want to characterize it as tort, but in many circumstances, we create special insurance that simply gets rid of the problems that might come with disputes in a civil court. So, for example, we have workers' compensation. You hurt yourself on the job, you're not going to sue your employer, you're just going to collect workers' comp. You have a car accident. You're not going to sue the other driver. You're just going to, there's car insurance mandated by the state, so that solved the problem, so there's no blood feud and no fights break out. Well, there might be a fight break out anyway, but see, we try to mitigate torts. But understand that torts are complicated. Sometimes, for example, I have a car accident with you. I'm at fault, drove through a red light. I hit you, I hurt you, insurance paid. Then I get a letter from a court, your wife is suing me. Now, why would his wife be suing me? Because there's a tort of denial of conjugal privilege. Think about what that would mean. In other words, your wife is going to sue me because you hit the steering wheel in just the wrong place. And you are no longer able to carry out your husbandly duties. And so, therefore, I have created a tort at distance against another person that was not in the car, but was adversely affected by what happened to the person in the car. So torts don't have to be in-your-face things. They can be at a distance. Your wife has never seen me, and yet I did something that she is saying has adversely affected your marriage. Now, obviously it didn't. You were no stud in before, but she's going to claim to the contrary. You understand, though. Torts are complicated. It is a whole area of law with many specializations, many stories. Tort of a cow that came through a roof, landed on a table, a guy was going to propose to his girlfriend. That was over for the night, and they never did get engaged because the cow just sort of ruined the relationship. She thought it was a sign from heaven. Cow falls through roof into restaurant. Okay? So there's a tort. The cow didn't do anything wrong. The pilot didn't do anything wrong. At least it doesn't seem. But a wrong against another was committed. That's tort law. Now, last one I'll bring up tonight. And then we get to contracts. Business law. Business law is so broad that I'll do two parts of it on Thursday. Regulatory and contract. It is deep, complicated. Fortunately, there are some things about it that are fairly straightforward. Business law, for the most part, you will deal in a civil world. Regulatory agencies, if you break rules, the regulatory agencies can approach you civilly. If you've done something that's criminally wrong, the regulatory agencies don't handle that. They would refer that matter with evidence that they had collected to the Attorney General of a state or to the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, Office of the Attorney General of the United States. But in general, it's civil law. For example, you might deal with EPA. That's civil. FTC, civil. SEC, civil. But if you go too far in what you're doing wrong, it can turn into a civil and a criminal matter, which turns into a nightmare. Because remember what I said, the government can prosecute you civilly and criminally, even though that sounds like double jeopardy. The Supreme Court has said it's not. So what they could do is and I saw this more than once, so they really want to destroy you, your company, they'll come at you civilly. You'll spend a fortune defending yourself against the charges in civil court. You will blow your money, and you will also reveal your defense. so that even if you are found not liable in civil court, they'll come right back around and prosecute you criminally. You're broke. They know exactly how you're going to defend yourself. You're dead. They can do it the other way. Criminal, and then knowing that they're not going to win, they can then, but they do destroy you financially, and they know how you're going to defend yourself. Then they can come back and nail you civilly. So it gets toxic. Fortunately, most regulatory agencies, at least in many eras, sometimes it's really bad, they try to avoid doing things like that. They'll work with you. They're not supposed to help you, but they will guide you and make sure that you don't get in too much trouble or accidentally. They'll say, we could fine you right here. You don't want to do this. Why don't you back down? We'll waive the fines. Work with us. So business law on that level isn't horrific, but it could be. But there's many other aspects of business law, and I'll get into the contract law, which is the most important part, on Thursday. But that's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.